At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
And to get things rolling here, I'm going to jump into some introductions as I always do. We'll start off here with Joseph Wang, our incumbent Fed guy, welcoming him back per usual to our FOMC panel as our go-to Fed guy. As many of you know, he headed trading at the Fed's open markets desk, has a great introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101, a must read, and is the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back as always, Joseph.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I love being on these panels. And it's great to see that Johnny's joining us today. Guys, Johnny's one of the top macro minds on Twitter. So it's a pleasure to have him part of this panel.
Thank you also for having me on the show here. We did do a great show with Joseph a few months ago, but I'm really honored to be on on a panel with such esteemed speakers.
So since we got that little precursor here on Johnny, I do want to welcome him back. It's been a while since we had Johnny here. He has over 25 years of experience investing and trading under his belt, with about half of that time spent with a macroeconomics focus at both Salomon Brothers and Brevan Howard. He currently runs his site, blog, and service, Super Macro, where he publishes in-depth market analysis and economic developments that affect the macro landscape. He even publishes his monthly portfolio returns, which isn't something we can say for everybody. Welcome back, Johnny, man. It's great to have you again.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on the show. I mean, it's a great honor to be here among these other guests. And I do feel a little bit out of my depth with some of the speakers that you've got on the show, but I'll do my best.
I think we all know you're going to do just fine, Johnny. Thanks for coming. Up next, we've got our man, Last Bear Standing, a frequent flyer on the Unusual Whales airline here, an expert on markets where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that, please do. That's going to go for every panelist here. You're going to miss out on a lot of great information and education by not following these folks. Welcome back, as always, Last Bear. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys. It's always an honor to get invited to the spaces. Glad I'm still getting that invite and to be here among some really great minds. So I'm looking forward to it today, the last FOMC of the year. We'll see what Powell has in store for us.
Absolutely looking forward to it. Next, we've got Jem Karsan, a leading volatility expert. We love having him here to get his point of view on all things volatility, launching tons of new and innovative things as we move forward into 2025, I'm excited to see what we've got coming out of Kai Volatility. Welcome back, Jim.
Good to be here. Great to be here with all these fellows. Always informative. I got to imagine end of the year, 2024, Trump coming in 4 weeks. There's a ton to talk about. So looking forward to learning and contributing and having a great conversation today. Thanks for having me.
And finally, we've got Bob Elliott back, the CIO at Unlimited Funds, former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of HFND. He brings vast knowledge and non-reactionary takes, which is a breath of fresh air in the climate of finance Twitter, as you all know. And it seems like forever since we've had him on, but it hasn't been quite forever. I think you were hanging out with us at the last few FOMCs, Bob. It's always great to have you here. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. I always love these spaces, because every time I'm on it, I'm trying my best to give a few insights, but I always take away something that makes me think from these great panelists. And so I appreciate you having me on, and look forward to the conversation.
As do I, Bob, and I think it's going to be a great one. So as always, before we really dive in here, I want to give out a quick macro overview since the last time we all got together for FOMC. So starting off here with CPI for November came in up 0.3% versus an expected 0.2%, bringing that year over year to 2.7%, which is right in line with estimates. GDP in the U.S. expanded at an annualized rate of 2.8% in quarter three, showing increased consumer spending. Housing costs, though they're not accelerating, do remain high, while some sectors are bracing for the potential consequences of incoming tariffs from the incoming administration to the White House. So as always, I like to get right into the thick of things here. To start us off, Joseph, I'd love a little Fed insight here. With inflation still hovering above 3% in late 2024 here, what is the Fed doing to curb inflation without triggering a recession? I know we've got a slew of potential rate cuts on the horizon in 2025, although the investor consensus seems to signal a rate cut today again. Arguably, the central bank may be a little less clear cut. So what are you thinking here, Joseph?
So I think in coming into this interview, it's helpful to have a little bit of background as to how we got here. Now, the last time, today is a dot plot meeting. The last time we got a dot plot was in September. And in September, the Fed did guide for another cut today. But the rationale back then was that they were kind of scared of where the economy was going. Their forecast in September were suggesting a jump in the unemployment rate to 4.4%, a slightly lower inflation, and a growth to be about 2%. And between now and then, the data has really surprised to the upside. We've had the unemployment rate, come up a little bit to 4.2, inflation a little bit hotter than expected, but GDP growth still pretty good. So basically, the economic data was much better than the Fed's forecast in September, and yet today they're still cutting. And I think that's been getting a lot of people scratching their heads. So the Fed, as we all know, doesn't like to surprise the markets, so this is well priced into the markets. This kind of started a couple weeks ago when Governor Waller at the Fed basically gave it away and told everyone that he kind of wants to cut, and the data has cooperated as well. I think listening to Chair Powell at his November conference, what I really came away with is that he thinks that inflation is basically all but mission accomplished. You hear him trotting out, 3 months annualized inflation, 6 month annualized inflation, shelter inflation is going to come down and so forth. So in his heart, it really sounds like he thinks that inflation is something that is really in the rearview mirror. So he's not concerned. And at the same time, he's looking at the unemployment rate tick up, and he's thinking that the level of rates right now is still significantly restrictive. And so he's eager to cut rates. And so I think that's why we're cutting rates today, and I'm going to cut rates next year as well, probably meaningfully more than what the market is pricing.
Thank you, Joseph. Jem, do you have anything to add to that? Do you agree? Are we looking at another rate cut today and several into 2025?
The Fed doesn't like surprising markets at the end of the year. There's a lot of end-of-year funding issues. There's generally banks need to have much more collateral on the sheets, much more cash on the sheets. And we've seen this at the end of the year several times, several spikes in LIBOR at the time. They don't want to surprise markets. So they will cut a quarter. They will do that. They've said they would. They will. I would be shocked if they don't. That said, I do think that the inflation picture is different when they started talking about all this cutting, and they would be foolish to ignore that, in my opinion. And I think they can't as much as they would like to. If you look at services inflation in particular, it has accelerated back up from as low as 3% or so up to 4%, and it never truly got down to where the Fed was looking to get it. That is the main problem. Now we're starting to see consumer prices, good prices also begin to participate in that. This is before, by the way, we've seen any tariffs, stronger immigration policy, all these things that, as much as we talk around them, are clearly structurally inflationary. I think they have to take that seriously. They also, you know, we have a new president coming in who has different policies, and they have to be thoughtful of that. They have to think about the whole picture. I think the dot plot's going to look very different this time. I think the market might be a little surprised by that, but I do think they're going to cut just because, again, end of the year, last thing they want to do is surprise markets despite that. I will add one last thing that I think is important. I don't think it's a coincidence, by the way, that the Fed is doing more or less what they did last year, or at least we're trying to, which is they got so much mileage out of being aggressive last December and saying, hey, let's cut. We're going to cut five times proactively to avoid a recession, et cetera, et cetera. And they got so much mileage out of that because in the spring, there was a housing kind of boom. There's so much sequestered demand for housing that it really, really unleashed an economic kind of growth cycle. And they didn't have to really do all the cutting, right? It was just all free, if you think about it that way. They learned from that and said, well, hey, why wouldn't we do that again? Why don't we get a little bit more aggressive here going into the end of the year? And that should really help people lock in lower rates for the spring and create a little bit more growth. Unfortunately, this time around, they're really spiking some inflation, the growth is not nearly as much this time around, given the cuts, because some of that sequestered demand was released last time around. So I think they tried to pull off, in my opinion, a little bit of the magic they got last time around, and are having less benefits in the ways they'd like. They're getting much more speculation in markets, which is a little dangerous while they're seeing a hotter inflation number. So I think that's a little bit of the picture of where they've been, where they're going right now.
Thank you, Jim. Johnny, I'd love your take here as well. Do you agree with what Jim said there about being a little hot to trot maybe, and it might not work quite as well as expected or in the past?
Yes, I do. The Fed has a challenge at this meeting. Just going back to what Joe was talking about, the summary of economic projections from September. At the time, the Fed projected PCE inflation would be 2.6, core PCE inflation would be 2.6% at the end of the year. It's going to be either 2.8 or 2.9% when we see the data, I think later this week. The Fed projected unemployment would be 4.4%. It's probably going to end the year more like 4.2%. And they predicted GDP growth of 2%. Now, we're about to have a third consecutive quarter of GDP growth running at a rate of about 3%. So since the September forecast projections, things in the economy are looking a lot better. Now, at that September meeting, the Fed was projecting, obviously, a cut this time around, and four further 25 basis point cuts in 2025. Now, the market, if you look at SOFR futures or Fed funds futures, the market has already, based on this recent data, has removed half of those cuts. The market's priced for just two more 25 basis point cuts after today's cut. That's in 2025. Now, I don't think the Fed can change their projections to kind of line up with the market. So the market's, you know, priced for two cuts. The Fed is not going to suddenly scrap two of the cuts that they've previously forecasted. I think the Fed will, this is just my opinion, I think the Fed will still forecast three 25 basis point cuts for next year. But you know, so somewhere that someone's going to be surprised. The market is going to, it's going to be a dovish surprise to the market in that respect. And let me just make this other point, that if you look at the history of Fed meetings, certainly since they started the hiking cycle, after virtually every single meeting that they have had, the two-year Treasury note has rallied, the yield on the two-year note has fallen after almost every FOMC meeting. In other words, whatever they do, Powell then steps up to the mic at the press conference and he gives such a dovish story that the market rallies. And I suspect we may well see that again this time. you know, if the market's expecting only two cuts, the Fed may well project three cuts for next year, and then Powell will get up in front of the press conference and do his usual thing and just rally the market. That's how things normally work out. So that's what I'm really expecting from this FOMC meeting. But it is true that economic growth has certainly been far stronger than the Fed expected. And inflation, I mean, if we look at inflation, core CPI inflation hasn't been below 3% for something like 3.5 years. It dropped to 3.2% in July, and it's 3.3% for the last couple of months, the last couple of readings that we saw. Wage growth is still north of 4%. I just don't see how, I don't see any way that the Fed's going to drive inflation back to target next year. And
at KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
You know, for the Fed to argue that financial conditions are tight, that's just a joke. That policy is restrictive. It's just a joke. You know, you've got equities near all-time highs. Credit spreads as tight as they've been in the last, almost as tight as they've been in the last couple of decades. Crypto is soaring. You've got even something called Fartcoin that people have put $760 million into. You've got the boss of some crypto company spending $6.2 million on a canvas with a banana taped to it. I mean, this is not just irrational exuberance. This is pure insanity. So financial conditions are not tight, but the Fed will go ahead with its easing, and we'll have to see the market reaction in about an hour or so.
Yeah, that whole thing with the banana drove me crazy. It's like, I got some Gorilla tape and some oranges. Does that count for something, at least in this economy? So speaking of the economy, I want to talk about GDP here for just a moment, and then I want to circle back to some more topics on inflation. But, Bob, the U.S. economy has thus far achieved a real GDP growth rate of 2.8% in quarter three here in 2024, and it still hosts an annual estimated growth of that 2.8. So, first, as part of like a two-parter here, what are some of the main factors that have driven this growth thus far, and are they expected to continue despite an incoming presidential transition?
Yeah, well, I think what we've seen over the course of the last couple of years is a continuation and a persistence of, you know, what I've described as the income-driven expansion. And the core of that expansion at some level is pretty boring, which is that, you know, cash compensation growth of households in the economy is running at 5 or 6% on a nominal basis. They are increasing, households are increasing their spending growth at 5 or 6% on a nominal basis. That's still a little too high relative to the productive capacity of the economy and the ability to generate supply, which is leading to inflation being, you know, above the target and getting, you know, real growth that continues at something like 2 to 3%. And you put that all together, the challenge is that that's a very sustainable expansion. It's almost boring. Like, what's GDP going to be? 2 to 3%, you know, every quarter, quarter after quarter. And I think it highlights two things. Well, and I should say, actually, and the important thing to recognize in that whole context is it's happening in an environment where there's essentially recession-like credit growth happening in the economy. And so you look at that picture and you say, is this an economy that is in need of hundreds of basis points of easing? And the answer is surely no, because it's pretty stable, has been stable over the course of the last 2 years at a time when interest rates have been, you know, at these current levels or above. And so I think the challenge, you know, basically what happened was, and I should say on a forward-looking basis, we're likely to see more expansionary fiscal policy, more regulatory relief, more spending, further tax cuts, et cetera. So not only are you getting an economy that is starting off here and has been in a place that's pretty good for the last couple of years with inflation too high, you're getting a monetary easing and then probably another kicker of fiscal support happening in the back half of 25. You put that all together, you know, that is a very, what I describe as sort of an over-easy, it's an over-easy monetary environment that's really not appropriate given the conditions we're seeing. But, you know, who cares what the Fed should be doing? What we should be looking at is what they are doing. And the answer is they're persistently delivering, you know, dovishness relative to expectations. I think, you know, what Supermacro just described is exactly right. And given that, that environment basically favors short-term interest rates, like 2 years, gold, stocks, and speculative garbage, relative to bonds. And that's basically what we're seeing play out over time. And what the Fed is sort of committing to continue that environment well into 25.
And it's funny you should mention, you know, the way people are kind of flooding into some of these investment assets, especially, I mean, equities. We've all been watching it, new high after new high after new high. It seems like it's kind of wash, rinse, repeat. The NQ dipped about 100 points in 5 minutes last night, and boom, we're right back up here overnight. And so, last bear, with that in mind and everything Bob outlined here with his views on GDP, do you foresee kind of these, you know, constant reaches to new all-time highs? Do you foresee that continuing, or does something have to give sometime soon? Thank you, Last Bear. Does anyone have anything to add to that? Maybe Jim or Joseph?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in here real quick. We've been talking about this on here for some time. I think we've got this steepener, you know, about as good as you could have gotten it here for the last year and a half. This inflation that we're seeing is structural. If you drill down what's driving things, it's labor costs. I mean, that's the biggest component. I mean, it's services inflation. It's super core. We had a bit of a pullback, that looked like there was a chance that it wouldn't continue. And then here we are right back at 4% in services inflation. I mean, the things that are driving that, we know, we understand. This is not a not understood thing, but the Fed seems to be whistling by the graveyard on this inflation. They are taking a very soft stance on inflation. And I think it's a little bit of a hope strategy at this point, candidly, especially with a Trump administration who is more likely than not, in some form or another, going to make labor inflation worse. You cannot close the border. You cannot deport, illegal immigrants and expect that not to have an effect on inflation. It's not popular, right, to have illegal immigration in a country. But the reason we were having historic immigration is because there's massive labor demand currently in the U.S. And that was helping keep a lid, despite it being hot, on those numbers. The second you start to put up the wall and deport people, and that may be popular, right? But that is going to create more structural inflation. And so I think the Fed waking up to that fact, is going to be interesting. We have had transitory inflation. At least this is the fourth time they've claimed inflation is transitory, and it has again and again proven not to be. So I would expect the Fed this year to really be in a pickle, and I think they're starting to catch wind of the fact that that's probably the case. And a different administration does make a difference. So I'll be curious to see kind of the commentary and the dot plots coming out of this.
Bob, see your hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we had talked, a number of people mentioned that it's going to be pretty tough for the Fed to out-hawk the market given the short-term pricing in 25. I just wanted to circle back to what Last Bear was highlighting, which is one of the ways that they could actually meaningfully surprise the market is on the long-term rate. And if they were to bump that up, you know, let's say to 3% here in the dots, maybe it won't go that high or whatever, but that's a way in which, frankly, they can look to continue to be easy while actually creating a tightening that they'd want. And so all eyes are there. There's going to be a hawkish surprise. That's where it's going to be.
I don't disagree with that at all. But I do think, and I've said this for a long time, that given the choice for the Fed between crushing the labor market or having an inflation rate that is north of 2%, somewhere between 2 and 3%, they'll take the latter. You know, they'd rather inflation was around 3% and the economy stays strong and unemployment stays low. So although they, in theory, have this 2% target, the reality is that, you know, we had a decade following the financial crisis when it was extremely difficult for them to get inflation to stay positive and to approach the 2% target from below. And, you know, at the time, rates were zero and there was nowhere else to go with rates. So the Fed really doesn't want to find itself back in that situation. It would prefer this situation where inflation is above target, but unemployment is low and economic growth is strong. And, you know, if we go back to what happened in the summer, we did have a slightly soft patch for employment. But if you look at the last three payroll figures, payroll growth, average monthly payroll growth in September, October, November was something like 50,000 higher than in the prior 3 month period, 50,000 per month higher than in the previous 3 month period. And that is during a time when, you know, we had the Boeing strike, we had the Stellantis layoffs, we had the hurricanes and all the rest of it. So the labor market seems to be okay at the moment. But, you know, the as far as the Fed is concerned, they want to keep the show on the road. And I do agree with what a number of the speakers have previously have said. The long end of the fixed income market is vulnerable here because if the Fed does stay too dovish for too long and inflation, core inflation continues to creep higher, super core inflation continues to rise, then I think you could get a very nasty situation in the fixed income markets, particularly with the increased issuance that we're going to face over the next few years. So, I do agree that the steepening trade, although it's consensus, that does seem to be the right trade.
One comment, I think we highlighted this middle of last year on here, but and it has yet to happen, but I think this could really be the year where the Fed starts talking about raising its inflation target. And I could see them raising that to 3 because it's becoming increasingly something that, as was highlighted by Johnny, you know, something they're just ignoring at this point. And I think the most likely case, especially under a Trump administration who will, I believe, want to run the economy hotter, I think they will like to do both fiscal and monetary stimulus in tandem. You know, they are going to have to find a way to change the rules to make that happen. So I do think they will choose, as Johnny highlighted, growth over inflation. I do think that's right. And I do think that means inflation will be significantly stickier and hotter than people expect going forward here. And I know people think that Trump can't affect monetary policy, but the reality is if Powell doesn't start playing nice, and both sides have to work together. You know, Trump will just put in a shadow, you know, will appoint the Fed, the next Fed president, and effectively have a shadow Fed in place. So I expect the Federal Reserve policy to become more growth focused than it even has been. And I think the net result is we're going to have to raise our expectations of inflation, even though that's probably already been the case in the Fed's back of their mind anyway. I think they're going to actually be forced to move that.
So I know in some cases that, aside from housing, which we'll get to in a bit, I have a few questions on that that I'd like to dive into, but some have kind of speculated that the Fed might even at this point, aside from the quote lagging metric of shelter, that job well done can pretty much start being touted. And so I'm curious, Joseph, do you agree with what Jem said about the potential of raising that inflation target to 3%? Or do you agree that the Fed might be in that job well done territory?
I remember that when we had inflation significantly above 2%, you had all these influential people writing op-eds, going on TV and saying, hey, you know, it's not so bad if we can raise the inflation target. That's okay, right? So I think if we ever get into a situation where inflation really is notably higher than target, I think we could change the target. But so recently there was an announcement from the Fed where, since they're doing their framework review right now, and the announcement mentioned that they're not changing.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Changing their target. And I think they're close enough to their target that they don't really have to do that. That's kind of something you do if you just can't meet your target. Now, going back to some of the commentary that has been mentioned, I think it's important to note that the Fed's mandate is not growth, but it's price stability and full employment. Now, this matters because you can get a lot of growth simply by bumping up your population, then you have more people working. But at the same time, you could also have the unemployment rate rise simply because you're adding more people. And so if you look back to what we've been having the past year, you've had the unemployment rate tick up, but at the same time, you have, we could say, above trend growth. So the Fed in this case wouldn't be focusing on that higher than expected growth rate. They'd be focusing on the rise in unemployment rate. Now, another thing I think it's really important is that when we are looking at financial conditions, I get the sense that often the Fed and the street are talking past each other. Now, everyone here on the panel, we're involved in markets. So we see, you know, Fartcoin going to the moon. We see Bitcoin going to the moon. We see the stock market going up every day. We all think that financial conditions are loose, and we can point to common financial condition indexes to support the same thing. But when you listen to the Fed, though, it's really clear that that's not what they focus on when they think about financial conditions. They're thinking about things like mortgage rates. Can the American middle class, can they afford a home? And that is also very important because it directly feeds into things like the housing sector, which employs a lot of people in construction. And we see housing starts have been steadily declining for the past year. It impacts things like credit card delinquencies, which, while not historically high, is on the higher end as it's been over the past 10 years. So from the Fed's perspective, and they've been asked about this and they're very open, they can't adjust interest rates based on where the Mag 7 is trading or how high Bitcoin is. That doesn't really speak to their mandate of full employment and price stability. And so they have to be looking at things like mortgage rates and so forth, which is why they can continue to tell you that financial conditions are significantly restrictive and they continue to want to cut. And I think there is some good rationale if you just look at, you know, where inflation metrics are, things like, you know, housing, we are trending lower. We're not there yet, but we are definitely trending lower.
Thank you, Joseph. A couple of points there as well that I want to touch on here in a bit. But first, before I pick on Last Bear a little bit, Bob, did you have anything to add to that prospect of the inflation target being raised to 3?
Well, essentially, no matter what, they're not going to talk about the inflation target raising to 3. The question is, you know, what are their actions in that context? And, you know, how are they running policy relative to the broad set of conditions that they see? And I certainly, if you were to look at really what happened on September 18th, I think it was an important moment where the reaction function changed. It changed for the third time since COVID, maybe the fourth time since COVID, where Chairman Powell basically said, he was making the argument that the labor markets were actually in pretty good shape and making the arguments that inflation was beat. And therefore, you know, the direction of travel and rates was clear and cuts were coming. And I thought that was very instructive, you know, because at the time it really defined a path forward of continuous over easy policy relative to sort of what you'd expect as a normal set of policies. If you, you know, looked across countries across time, he basically reset the reaction function dovish. And so, you know, is the target 2, is the target 3? Who knows exactly how they're thinking about it. What I would say is what seems pretty compelling is that any time the Fed has the ability to surprise in a way that's more dovish than what's expected relative or what's going on relative to economic conditions, that's what they're going to deliver. And so you just have to, you have to accept that that is the new reaction function we sit in, and maybe that'll change in the future, maybe it won't, but for the time being, that's the reaction function that they're delivering. And we're, you know, we're likely to see more of the same here today.
Thank you, Bob. So what I want to do here, we got about 23 minutes until we get a little bit of data for the Fed meeting, about an hour and some change before the presser. So what I want to do here is kind of curl back to that topic of GDP, specifically this time from the perspective of consumer spending. Now, concerns surrounding consumer spending have kind of ebbed and flowed throughout the last couple of years during and since COVID. But November numbers seemed somewhat positive, with U.S. retail sales rising by 0.7% versus only a 0.5% increase estimate. Many saying this growth was largely fueled by a large jump in motor vehicle sales as well as online shopping. But at the same time, sectors like food services, clothing stores, those experienced declines. And when we look at things like critical categories such as housing, food, energy, they're kind of holding those elevated levels. And so the question that I have in regard to consumer spending, these upticks in consumer spending, is what role do things like rising wages versus inflation play in this driving of consumer spending? And to a little bit of a tail end two part here, are consumers increasing real consumption, or is this growth primarily a result of the inflation of products? Let's start with Last Bear here, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so just say on the last point, I think you can look at it, you know, it's easy enough to look at it both ways, nominal or real. But what I'd encourage people to do is go to, you know, the Federal Reserve's economic website and plot personal consumption expenditures in nominal terms and plug it in real terms and show GDP on top of that. And what you'll see is that PC and GDP sort of follow. GDP is sort of lagging because they report it quarterly, but you can see the trend of where GDP is going with where those PCE numbers are heading. And over the past couple of months, it looks like it's inflecting upward to some degree. I think that to your point about the retail sales, I think most consumption indicators seem to suggest a strong holiday season that we're going into now. I think after a little bit of a muted one last year, consumer sentiment broadly has increased. I think that there's some political elements in that as well, just with the election and whatnot. But I think that it's hard to say right now. And I think, sorry, another point, just you mentioned the delinquencies, or somebody mentioned delinquencies. That was sort of a rising issue that was really steeply, you know, the level of delinquencies in autos and credit, credit cards. That was rising pretty substantially around this time last year. But we started to see that. I think it's still technically on the rise, but it's really begun to plateau. And you've seen companies that focus on sort of consumer credit really perform quite well this year, as the expectations for where that peak in delinquencies is going to be, I think, has turned out to be lower than expected. So I think it's hard to find a lot of data that suggests that the consumer is very strapped at this point. If anything, it looks like a strong holiday season, strong end of the year, and strong start to the beginning of 2025.
Jim, I see your hand, but real quick, Les Bear, a quick follow-up on that in regards to consumer credit. I know I picked on you a lot about that on the, in the past. And again, like you said, it seems to be slowing down, leveling off a little bit, but we are still sitting at some all-time highs in terms of credit outstanding in the consumer area. And so I wonder, do you think that the recent push to really cap those credit card limits on consumers will have any real heavy effect on those delinquencies and credit card debts?
I think you bring up a good point, which is that there's a sort of reaction function between lenders and borrowers. And so you have a lenders deciding whether they're willing to lend and at what terms they're willing to lend, and sort of looking at the ultimate spread between the profit that they're making and delinquency rates. And so if you look at different sort of lending across the board, both to consumers and sort of broadly, if you look at the SLOOS data or just sort of bank loan data, what you see is that banks' willingness to lend have increased. It sort of reached its bottom point about the middle part of last year and continues to increase towards a more positive lending environment. And I think that the fact that you see this aging of delinquencies, which a lot of them sort of were for balances that were created in the middle of COVID, what you see is as those are aging, you see the delinquencies come through, but newer vintages are actually performing pretty well. So I think broadly on the consumer credit front, you have a pretty positive story.
Thank you, Les Bear. Jim, what did you have to add to what Les Bear was saying?
So wage growth is running at about 4%. Services inflation is running at about 4%. 50 to 75% of services inflation is labor. I think the big thing to highlight about the reason services inflation has been, so there's a direct link in my mind, that the reason services inflation has been so hot recently is actually because of that as well. I mean, the parts, the components that have actually been slowing are tied to rent and other items that are not directly, more housing related. It's actually been even hotter than that. So that is what's driving the issue. And it's been going on for some time. If you look at what service inflation is, it's essentially local inflation. It's labor, which you cannot import, right, as easily, especially given the environment, the protectionist environment we're in. And it's housing, which you, again, can't import. We have significant supply constraints. So we've yet to, recently we're starting to see, the non- kind of local, I guess I would say, the goods part of inflation increase, but that's been negative, right? That's been the part holding CPI down. So I beg the question, what happens when we put tariffs up or we start to go into more protectionist policies in terms of global trade? This has been in the context of a China that has been lagging, emerging markets that have been really lagging. If we run the economy hotter as well, and global growth actually not just U.S. growth, but global growth accelerates, I see a dramatically worse picture for inflation. We've had a lot of things going our way. And candidly, if any number of those change, I think you're looking for at a much worse picture. That's what break-evens are telling you. If you look at break-evens closely, you know, we're up almost 0.9% since September. I mean, that's for five, you know, for 5 year, for sorry, for 2 year inflation, tips, you know, the break-even rate is up 0.9%. 5 year is up 0.5%. I mean, those are dramatic numbers for that short a period. So this is real. The market's waking up to it. And I think it's honestly just the beginning.
So I actually want to touch a little bit on labor. We've brought it up a few times. I think it's time I let us dive right into it instead of cutting you guys off to jump around topics here. So let's dig a little bit more into that. As Jim mentioned, Donald Trump has said he plans to carry out, as he put it, the largest mass deportation of undocumented immigrants in U.S. history upon his return to the White House. So I'm curious for the entire panel's take here, but we'll start with Johnny. What effects might we see on the economy and for jobs and wages should this come to fruition, particularly in sectors where the reliability on immigrant labor is really high, such as agriculture, construction, and hospitality? So, Johnny, I'd really love your take here, especially given your super macro piece earlier this month, exploring jobs, jolts, and hiring.
Well, first of all, I do want to say that I think Trump's bark in the past has been worse than his bite. And although he pledges to just deport all these illegal immigrants, I doubt very much that there's going to be, you know, officials doing house to house searches, rounding them up and putting them on a boat back to wherever they came from, or sending them across the border to Mexico. I think the first port of call will be the those with a criminal conviction. The what I would call the soft targets, they can certainly be deported fairly easily. It depends how far the new administration goes with this pledge to deport the illegal immigrants. But if he were to carry out his threat fully, certainly you'd see the cost of labor going higher. I mean, I'm actually currently in California, and you know, I don't know how this state would cope without mainly Mexican house cleaners, gardeners, pool service guys, and all the rest of it. And the same for all the hotels. You know, so much of the labor is immigrant labor, whether it's documented or undocumented. You know that's beside the point. You know, if all the undocumented labor was deported, there'd certainly be a steep rise in the cost of labor. So that's one of the factors where I think we're going to see labor costs going higher. And what you mentioned just earlier, you know, in my piece from last month, I looked at some of the forward-looking indicators of labor demand, which have ticked higher recently. I mean, the NFIB, the Small Business Optimism Survey, the plans to hiring were up quite dramatically. And if you look at, you know, the Indeed and the JOLTS data, the job demand there ticked higher. Various other forward-looking indicators have signaled a return of a stronger labor demand. The only thing that has concerned me, the only thing that does concern me, is we still have quite an elevated level of continuing claims in the weekly data, the weekly jobless claims data, which suggests that those people that have been let go are taking longer to find a new job. So it's not all clear cut about the labor market. There are some aspects of it that show a slightly less demand than there was before. But certainly, I mean, you know, with the new administration, with the increased business confidence, I think a lot of the small businesses, well, most of them do, are do lean Republican. And I think the new administration, once already we've seen confidence surging among the small businesses, their hiring plans and their CapEx plans that may have been put on hold ahead of the election, you know, they'll now probably put them in, go ahead with them. So on balance, I think we're going to see stronger labor demand. And if the supply does get restricted, you're bound to see an impact on the price of that labor.
So you actually said something there that I wanted to touch on next regarding the duration of joblessness. So as of November of this year, those who have been unemployed long-term accounted for over 23% of all unemployed individuals, and the number of long-term unemployed persons, which is categorized by those jobless for 27 weeks or more, stood at approximately 1.6 million people, with roughly 40% searching for work for more than 15 weeks. So I'm going to pick Bob here, and we can kick this one around a bit. What does this seemingly elevated number of long-term unemployed say about the jobs landscape? Because I know the Fed's been saying that the jobs market's been pretty strong, but even though unemployment numbers themselves aren't necessarily super high, the duration of joblessness seems to be getting longer. So is this a precursor to potentially higher jobless rates? What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think one of the reasons why you look at things like hiring rates is because you think that it gives you a lead on what's going on with overall employment conditions. And I think one of the challenges with looking under the hood at the labor market in the last couple of years is that there's sort of this overwhelming bullwhip that's happening, where there was an extraordinary boom in, I don't know where that came from, but I thank you. Thank you for that applause. There was this extraordinary boom in hiring, and in 22 and part of 23, and then, you know, basically businesses were like, we're stuffed with hires. We're going to need to get some, you know, some attrition going that, you know, isn't going to lead to direct firing, but it is going to help bring down the over hiring that we did. And so if you just, as a simple example, took the hiring rate over the last 3 years and you just averaged it, the average is the same rate that existed in the pre-COVID period when the labor markets were pretty tight. It's just we've had this bullwhip effect. I think the main thing when you're looking at what's going on in terms of predicting what's happening in the labor markets, I think you got to look at the firings rate, because that really gives you an indication of whether or not, you know, businesses are actually proactively letting labor go. And when you look there, you have a firings rate that is basically as low as it's been ever. And so I think what that highlights is, sure, if you're looking for a job, this is not a good time to be looking for a job. Absolutely. And there's a lot of anecdotal stories that will highlight that. But at the level of, is this a rapidly, you know, does the hiring rate decline, is that indicative of some rapid deterioration in labor markets? No, it's the outlier data, not the well triangulated data when you look across a whole bunch of different data sources in terms of the labor market.
Jim, go ahead.
So I want to highlight a couple statistics that I thought might be interesting. Very few people actually sit down and look at, you know, we talk about immigration, how much actual immigration do we have, legal, illegal here in the US, and what is that as a percentage of the total labor? I think that's important. We don't need to see, by the way, all of the deportations. I agree, Trump tends to have more bluster than he actually ends up following through with, but that said, that's also a possibility. But we don't need to be clear to start exporting illegal immigrants to have a labor problem. In 2024, we had a total of 3.6 million immigrants come to the United States, 2.5 illegal, 1.1 legal. In 2023, we had 3.2 million illegal immigrants come and about a million legal. we're talking an average run rate of about $4 million a year. In the context of a total labor of 160 million, right? So we're talking about significant, dramatic immigration that we've been seeing, well above what we've seen historically. And if you start talking about four, I mean, we're talking 2.5% increase in labor. If you just stop that or cut it in half, the amount of given how inelastic labor supply is and wages are, you're dealing with a major problem. So I don't think we need to see the people being rounded up. And by the way, they will do some of that. Some of that will be theater. They will definitely start with illegal people with felonies and other issues. But the point here is just stemming inflation, stemming labor supply by limiting immigration is going to be a major problem.
I have something to add about that. So we definitely have, I mean, if we were to deport lots of people, we would definitely have less labor. But something else to keep in mind is that the labor force participation could rise. I think one of the great tragedies in the U.S. is that over the past 50 years, the labor force participation for men, particularly non-college educated men, has just declined tremendously. You know, 50 years ago, the labor force participation of non-college degree holding men was, you know, 95%. Today, it's like 82%. So you have millions and millions of people who have just fallen out of the labor force. Maybe they're all Bitcoin millionaires somewhere, but you have to know that, you know, these people used to have blue collar jobs. And one of the reasons that they don't is because they can't compete with labor that is willing to work for a lot less. And part of this huge populist era that we're in, and Jim talks a lot about this, is having to revitalize the US such that these working class people can have better jobs. And yes, it is inflationary. And as Johnny mentioned, you know, the Fed probably does weigh labor more than inflation. If you look at the composition of the FOMC, those guys, tons of people that have been appointed, they are labor economists. So we probably will have inflation higher than it used to be. But then that seems to be the popular ethos. That's what the political forces want. They want to be America first. And that means restructuring the economy such that, you know, these people who have been left out of prosperity, who are fallen out of the labor market, can come back in. And one way to get that is to have fewer illegal migrants and push wages higher so that these people can participate. And one other thing that I will note, and we've all discussed, you know, Trump says many things, some of which would happen, some of which will not happen. He went on the All In podcast, and maybe because he was talking to a bunch of tech CEOs, but he was saying that, you know, if you graduate from a U.S. college, we're going to give you a green card. Now, obviously, that made all the tech CEOs, their eyes all lit up. They love to hear that. But there is a possibility that rather than, say, just kick all the illegal immigrants out, we could be changing the composition of our migrants so that they are higher skilled rather than low skilled. And I think that would actually make a lot more sense for our economy, particularly given the very low labor force participation rates of some of the some parts of our demographic.
Bob, I saw you had your hand up there. Was that a real one or was that a Twitter trolling me hand?
It was not a Twitter trolling you hand. I think Joseph highlighted it, but all roads lead to higher wages, and higher wages without an increase in productive capacity lead to higher inflation. That's the story. These are all trade-offs, and can be that in order to revitalize, you know, non-college educated, you know, men in middle America, we offer much higher wages, but the consequences of that are that we're going to have an economy with higher inflation. And so, those are just the trade-offs and the choices kind of as Jim was saying is, no matter sort of how you look at the policy mix, maybe other than possibly regulatory relief, it's all pointing in the direction of inflationary rather than less inflationary ahead.
Oh. Yeah, and this is why I think I could see an acceptance, a broad acceptance of higher inflation. There's nothing that says that 2% is set in stone. If we choose politically to maximize to median incomes as opposed to GDP, right, which is essentially the political, you know, or the mean, the political wins and what we're doing here in the US and a lot to a broad extent globally, that is structurally inflationary. And maybe that inflation is worth it, I guess. That is a flat tax ultimately. So there's a reflexive circular problem because then labor also gets frustrated once again by the inflationary pressures. But at the end of the day, you know, that is the cost. You send money to labor, you do fiscal spending, you do protectionist policies. That is a velocity of one, right? Monetary policy has a velocity of close to zero. So I think that's the big story. We've been talking about it for a while. We continue to go down that path, and if anything, it's accelerating. And I think important to stay in touch with.
Thank you, Jim. And in the meanwhile, we did get the drop. Nobody is surprised, I'm sure, to see that the 25 bips cut did occur as anticipated. So give the panelists a moment here to look over the drop, take a peek at some dot plots, and let me know what you're seeing as you see it.
So I think we might have nailed the long-term median coming up a little bit. I believe that that's going to come out to 3% now, up from, I think, 2.8% before. But a big move in the long-term rate, which sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yes. So I think also it's important to note that the Fed has lowered their forecast for rate cuts for 2025. They're now just expecting 50 basis points of rate cuts in line with what the market was pricing. And of course, you know, treasuries are selling off now quite hard. And I can't imagine that equities are going to do too well, but they're holding in there for the time being.
Now, all in all, it's a clear upgrade of the economic outlook, right? So growth a little bit higher, but, you know, the unemployment rate projections coming down lower and inflation coming hotter for next year. So as Johnny mentioned, they are pricing in fewer cuts because they're upgrading their outlook on the economy.
And this is what I was saying. Yeah, I don't think they can, as much as they would like to remain dovish. You know, yes, they had to deliver the quarter point today, like we talked about, but actually, you know, that dot plot has to come down, right? Given these, what we're seeing in break-evens, that we're seeing dramatic moves. I think people are not talking enough about the inflationary pressures and the Fed ignoring that is a major problem, especially given the new administration and the new policies.
Yeah. I think it's really a kind of mark to market of their projections, because since the previous summary of economic projections, things do look a lot better. Unemployment's lower than expected, inflation is higher, and growth has been quite a bit stronger. I'm just surprised that they actually reduced that they made such a dramatic about turn. It's quite something. Normally they're extremely dovish at each of these FOMC meetings. We'll have to wait and see what Powell has to say.
But again, the moves in inflation, I mean, 0.9% move in break even since September in 2 year inflation. I mean, those are dramatic, and that's in the face of declining gas prices. You cannot ignore the market when it speaks that loudly. And I think the Fed has to have.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that even though the Fed in the dots penciled out fewer cuts than what was previously expected, let's not forget inflation is above target. GDP growth is running at 3%. The unemployment rate is low. Labor markets continue to add jobs, and yet the Fed is cutting like hell, right? And so it doesn't, these are wiggles, these are tweaks amongst a broader range of saying, hey, look, you know, what would be appropriate monetary policy for this set of economic conditions is no cuts at all. In fact, we even got one dissenter who agreed.
I'm surprised by how hawkish this is as well. But they did meet the market. And I think probably it's because we have a dissenter. It looks like it was a contentious FOMC meeting. Again, this is, we had, Bowman dissent a couple meetings ago, and now we have another dissenter. It looks like this is one of the newer Fed presidents. So I guess we'll hear what Powell has to say at his presser as to how that negotiation went and find out more at the minutes when they release later on in January.
Right.
I'd be curious to see if there is one last thing. I'd be curious to see if there is, you know, political pressure. You know, that dissent is interesting, right? And this is not a conspiracy, right? We have an incoming new president who is, I'm sure, lobbying for certain types of policies. So I'd be curious to see if there's any, external political pressure that's maybe causing a little bit more dissent, or at the very least, if the view of an incoming president and those potential policies is also weighing on this quick turn.
I would just add that we've seen the 10-year now cross the 1-month treasury rate for the first time in quite some time. So just a milestone to recognize as we see the steepening happening.
All right, so let's spin things back. And of course, if anything else comes up as you review, feel free to chime in. FOMC is just a little more pressing because it's just happened. But I want to pick everybody's brains here on bonds. With that yield curve still inverted as of this month, I'm curious, especially when compared to last year before when this topic's come up, how concerned should market participants be at this point about the potential for a recession in 2025, given that investors have historically preceded downturns? Are there any signs that this time may be different? Let's start with Johnny here.
Yeah, since the yield curve first inverted 2.5 years ago or so, and people were saying, well, this means a recession is on the way, I've had a very firm view that it's not the case. And that's still the same today. I think the whole point about the short-term rates being higher than long-term rates is that if market participants believe that the Fed's short-term policy rate is going to slow the economy and perhaps drive it into a recession, they will extend duration and lock in the rates that are there the longer term rates before they decline too. And that is why you have this inverted yield curve. But, and I'm sure it's been discussed on the show previously, you know, the household sector has locked in low mortgage rates. I mean, household financial obligations as a share of total income are really the lowest they've been in half a century, because people on average have a mortgage, the average existing mortgage rate is just below 4%. And it's a similar situation for corporates. If you look at corporate interest as a share of total income, it's as low as it's been in several decades. So the Fed's short-term policy is not having the same impact on the economy as it might have done in the past. So that's point number one. And point number two, there was this idea that if the Fed is too dovish, then the long end could sell off. And, you know, I discussed that as well. But the other side of that is that if the Fed really is going to be hawkish and rates are going to stay relatively high for some extended period, and there is the threat that inflation will continue to stay high, then there's absolutely no point in extended duration. You might as well stay in 3-month bills and keep rolling them, or 1-month bills. You might as well stay in the short term where there's less risk, because if inflation really does pick up again, then the Fed may have to start hiking. You're much better off in keeping duration very, very short term. And so I think that's why we're seeing a sell-off here in the long end of the fixed income. And certainly equities are taking it on the chin now. I was surprised they held up as well as they did when they did. But that seems to be turning around now.
Thank you, Johnny. So I also, just to keep this going on bond yields, there's been a recent increase in municipal bond yields, as many have noted. And so, Joseph, I'm wondering what factors are really contributing to this, and how might the increase affect financing in the markets as we cross this threshold into 2025?
So I haven't followed the muni bond yields. I can't speak to that. On longer dated rates, so I think of longer dated rates as largely a reflection of the expected path of Fed policy. Again, you have, you know, a spread above that as well. But, you know, I continue to think that we're going to get more rate cuts next year than the market expects. So I don't think the long yields will continue to rise. So I'm not really worried about that. I mean, if you look at it from a bigger picture perspective, there's so many things that the administration can do if they thought the long yield was too high. I mean, you can have some banking regulation that would make it easier for banks to buy treasuries. Again, looking, zooming out globally, outside of the US, things are not doing well. And of course, the unemployment rate continues to rise. So I'm not too worried about the long end going higher.
On that note there about the rising unemployment rate, do we think that that might be the primary reason for the one descent that we saw today?
I don't know. It could just be concerns about inflation, but we guess we'll find out when Chair Powell maybe talks a little bit about what their discussions were.
And so a little bit more with bonds here. The trajectory on the 10-year especially does seem to be pointing up yet again after a little bit of a dip in the past month or so. As of yesterday, it was sitting around 4.4%. I'll be honest, I haven't looked at it today, especially since the Fed minutes drop. Now, earlier this year, numerous pundits voiced a prediction where the 10-year would crack above that 5% mark. And so I wonder, just while we're on the topic, Last Bear, does that 10-year again seem on that path toward 5% as it was in October of last year? And if it cracks that mark, what connotations would that carry for the wider markets?
Well, I think that the 5% has been a pretty hard line in the sand for the bond market. If you look back to October 2023, where 10-year hit the peak of this cycle, it sort of bounced right off the 5% mark. And even when we sort of had the higher for longer narrative earlier this year, we didn't quite get to 5%. But I guess more directly to your point, could we see the 10-year cross 5%? I do think, I don't know that it's a base case, but I absolutely think that it's a possibility, given the dynamics that we've been discussing throughout this call, what we've discussed about sort of the increase in the neutral rate, what we've discussed about the stability of the economy, even despite the current high interest rates that we have. So if we see the, you know, the short-term rates hover around maybe sort of plateau around 4%, let's say, which may be on the hawkish side of the predictions right now, but I think is a reasonable case, then I think it's totally reasonable that you could see the 10-year go over 5%. And for a certain category of company and borrower, I think that is a big shift, especially given that the expectations for the past year and a half, 2 years, is that rates are coming down. And so people have been able to sort of amend and extend and sort of wait for relief to come. If that relief doesn't come, and if we see 10-year yields above 5% and holding there for longer than expected, as people start to come up on maturity walls, you know, debt that was issued back in 2020, 2021 coming due, then I think you could start to see for certain leveraged borrowers this becoming an issue. And even at, you know, some banks, I know it's the sort of unrealized loss topic it's kind of been one that's out there for a long time. And we saw some casualties of that a year and a half ago, but we haven't heard a lot since then. I do think that as you start to have new bank rules come in around capital requirements, and you start to have, you know, you could potentially see larger losses on loan books and security books, that banking stability could potentially enter the issue, or, you know, enter the discussion at some point if we see high rates.
Thank you. Does anybody have anything to add on the topic of bonds before I pick on Jem about volatility in a moment? All right, so let's talk shop on VIX a little bit. As of yesterday, December 16th, the VIX closed at 15.87, which some would argue is relatively low, kind of not otherworldly, not crazy high. So compared to that 15.81, the realized volatility, however, was approximately 9.7, according to New York University Stern VLab. So, Jem, how should investors interpret the current somewhat low VIX relative to the underlying realized volatility spikes to as high as above 15% in November, for example, and right back down? And kind of as a follow-up to that, what are you seeing in options pricing relative to vol?
Yeah, so we've been out publicly talking about this for some time. There are structural effects here into the end of the year. Flows, positive flows, they are dramatic into this week. The peak of that was Monday into Wednesday here. VIXpiration usually marks the end of that kind of window, or you know, the beginning of the end. Obviously, the big print in the AM on Friday is the official end of the VANA and charm flows, all the positive buyback. You have $500 billion increase in the last 2 years of structured product issuance. That's a doubling to about $1 trillion in structured product issuance. The majority of these are tied to the end of the year, are tied to these 20th contracts, which are the most liquid. These are the LEAPs that have been on the board for years. All of the put positioning there versus the call positioning leads to this decay of puts, which is it leads to massive buyback. Again, those flows, once they are gone, are gone. They do not, they have passed. And I was very clear on Monday, actually, publicly, that given those amount of flows, given the amount of positive structural demand there has been, the action in the markets has been very concerning. That was the warning sign. I mean, that's it. It's a litmus test. When you know these flows are there and they're as big as they are, yet the market can't seem to get above its highs, kind of keeps going sideways near the highs, that is the thing that's the warning sign. So understand, as we get here from now to the end of the year, yes, there is some releveraging effect at the end of the year. There are some positive forces that will make it so that this does not roll over dramatically between now and the end of the year. However, after that last releveraging effect at the end of the year, beginning of the year, this market opens itself up for a significant amount of increased downside. That doesn't mean the world's going to crash necessarily, but the positive flows are off the table at that point. You have a lot of people in, and that was showing up in vol. So we saw market up, vol up. The back of the curve has been accelerating higher. People who understand that are institutional traders saw what is happening and have been bidding up the long of the end of the curve. There have been several vol, quote unquote, experts out there kind of saying, oh, no, that's not really, it's structural. It's just a function of the, the truth is there is a significant structural demand to vol that's been happening in the back end of the curve. That is the back end of the curve exclusively. The calendars have been expanding dramatically. And that's because the vol is well supplied in the short term in the DEES contract, DEES 31st contract. You also have the overhang of a big seller in the JP Morgan, hedged equity trade. These are all structured trades that are going to happen that the world knows is out there. But after that short-term supply, after these VANA and charm flows pass, after the releveraging flows that are out there, these are all structural. The world is overly positioned and does not see kind of what lies on the other side. So that would be my view. Again, we've been talking about this publicly. This decline here that we're seeing today is not a surprise. It will continue to be. You will get bounce backs here between now and the end of the year. It should be a stair step down type situation. Be more cautious as you get into the early year for an extension down to 10, maybe even 15% in the market.
Thank you, Jim. So one other topic I wanted to get to before I kind of pass around the panel for some closing remarks and then jump over to Jerome Powell's presser. It's a topic we haven't really talked about on recent FOMC panels, and the hype around it kind of died down, but my curiosity got the better of me when I was prepping today's panel. In September of this year, reverse repos ranged on average from $70 billion to $100 billion. And in October, that range expanded to $100 to $140 billion. And then again, in November and December, we saw even more increases ranging from $118 to $180 billion. So Joseph, first, is this even something that's interesting? Is this information that people should know? And also, how might this increased demand for liquidity affect the broader credit markets, particularly in relation to bond yields?
So I think the level of the RRP is a good indicator of a couple of things. One is that it's a good indicator as to when the Fed might stop quantitative tightening. So one of the first things that they would think about when they're thinking about when to stop QT is to see if there's still a lot of money in the RRP. If there is, that means that from their perspective, that there's still abundant liquidity in the financial system and they can continue QT. Once that approaches zero, we could think about maybe the QT might stop. And you know, stopping QT is generally pretty good for bond yields because that means the Fed is not shrinking the balance sheet anymore. Another way this is important is that as, you know, let's say the RRP level drops, you could potentially have, you know, increases in repo rates because there's less extra cash that goes to finance the repo market. And when you have higher financing costs, that could have some upward pressure on yields as well. But because your financing costs go up, maybe that impacts what you're willing to pay on the asset side. So that's how I would look at this. Right now, it doesn't seem like it's a big deal. One interesting thing is that the Fed has also talked about having a technical adjustment in the future. And that tells me that they really want to extend QT because as one of the side effects of having lower levels of liquidity in the financial system, from their perspective, is higher money market rates. But you can kind of just goose that system by having a technical adjustment, which would put money market rates lower just across the board. And if you do that, that gives you more runway for a longer QT. So based on what I see right now, we can still do QT for, you know, at least several months. It shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you, Joseph. Les Bear, you've written pretty extensively about the RRP in the past. Did you have anything to add to what Joseph said?
No, I agree. I think that was a good summary. I think as it gets closer to zero, which it is now, I think there's just a little bit over $100 billion left, which sounds like a big number, but is not relative to where it's been and where it's trending. It starts to put pressure on the Fed to, you know, it's really a mechanism that ensures that their target rate on the short end is achieved. And so it opens up the possibility for more variability in short-term markets. And I think it does impact their decision with respect to quantitative tightening as they're looking at ample level of reserves in the banking system and whatnot. There is the situation, you know, there's still $750 billion or so in the Treasury General Account, which is a good deal of liquidity that might start to come back in the market earlier next year. But I think in the back half of 2025, this issue around sort of technical liquidity levels in the banking system and short-term rate markets might become a bigger issue.
Thank you, Les Bear. So we've got about 6 minutes until the presser. So what I want to do here is just go around the panel. Any topics that you feel we didn't hit enough or anything that you wanted to just brush up on that you didn't get a chance to, please feel free to now. We'll start with Johnny here.
Oh, wait, one thing I just said. It looks like they might actually have done a technical adjustment because the RRP rate is 30 basis points lower, but I'll double check that.
Interesting. Thank you, Joseph.
Yeah, okay. Just in summary, it's a much more hawkish meeting result than I expected. In the past, it's always been a dovish FOMC. They may have hiked, but they've given dovish guidance, and the Powell has given a dovish press conference. This time they've cut the rates, but the outlook is much more hawkish than I expected or the market expected. And as a result, we're seeing the long end of the treasury market decline, and we're seeing equities a little bit lower. I will say this, the equity market seems pretty invincible because it seems like whatever the Fed does, you may get a sell-off for a day or two or a small pullback, but it will be making new highs before too long. So we'll have to see how this turns out.
Absolutely. Thank you, Johnny. And again, thanks for coming. It was really great to have you here again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being on the show. I feel I've learned a lot from the other speakers.
Yeah, I always realize how little I know every time I host these. Joseph, did you have anything else to add before we jump to J-PAL?
No, I think this was surprised me. It was hawkish, more hawkish than I expected. But let's listen to what J-PAL is saying. It does seem like he has a bit of a mutiny on his ship. So I think it'd be an interesting presser.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if any other dissidents kind of come along as we move forward to future FOMC minutes. Jim, any last things you wanted to touch on before we send folks into the presser?
Yeah, dissidents. I expect more dissidents. We can talk about that next Fed meeting and point to it here as the first one. But I do think the political winds are changing a bit. The desired policy by policymakers is changing a bit. I think the Fed is going to be head-to-head with a different system, and that will lead to a little bit more volatility in not just interest rates and policy, but FX, inflation. I think this is a good sign of more to come.
Thank you, Jim. Last Bear, anything you wanted to add here before we send people into the presser?
No, just thanks again for having me. This was a really great discussion. If you like anything that I said here, you can check out my Substack or follow me here on Twitter. I think we had a good discussion here today. Thanks, guys.
And thank you, Last Bear. Joseph, did I already hit you or did I forget somebody?
No, you hit me, but I also wanted to add, thanks so much for having me. I always learn a lot. It was a pleasure to be on this panel.
And it's always a pleasure to host this. Everybody out here in the audience, make sure you're following these folks. Like I said earlier at the top of the show, constant good education and information coming from these guys. I know that they are invaluable follows for me. They all have writing that they do. They all have YouTube channels that they do. But this is great. I think today was very productive. We hit pretty much every topic I wanted to in really good detail. Thanks again, everybody, for coming, and I hope the rest of your day is glorious.